And one of the best ways to keep peace between two neighboring countries is to marry off the children of the rulers among each other. It's a very simple way. That may not always be the most romantic or most pleasant path for the children, but in my book I claim that we should think twice about this. But it is almost guaranteed to keep peace between neighboring countries.
Join the best in the movement. It's Conservative Conversations with ISI, educating for liberty since 1953.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conservative Conversations with Marlo Slayback and Johnny Burtka. Today we are pleased to welcome the Archduke Edward Habsburg to the podcast. Edward is Hungary's ambassador to the Holy See and the Sovereign Order of Malta. His family reigned in Austria, Hungary, Germany, Spain, and quite a few other places for nearly 700 years. He and his wife have 6 children. Edward is the author of several books, including the children's book, Doobie, The Double-Headed Eagle, and now out with Sophia Institute Press, The Habsburg Way, 7 Rules for Turbulent Times, which he joins us to talk about. It's an honor to have you with us, Edward.
Good morning from Rome.
Thank you, Edward. And before we begin our interview, we'd like to thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations. This podcast is a production of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, and our mission is educating for liberty. So if you'd like to join us in fulfilling our mission, please be sure to rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts to help us reach more listeners like yourself. So your book has 7 rules or principles, and we'll definitely be discussing those as much as we can during our time today. But before we dive in, perhaps you can tell us more, and our listeners especially, maybe who haven't, who don't have, know too much about the Habsburg family, more about your family history and more about your current post with the government of Hungary. So what's it like being a member of a great European royal family in the 21st century?
That's a very good starting question. One of the first things is that, of course, what is it like to grow up like a Habsburg? It's the only experience I ever had, but I will try to make you understand how it is. It's very strange. The first time you usually understand that you're something different is in school, when your teacher in history class looks at you and says, well, this is something that Mr. Habsburg surely should be able to tell us something about. And of course, you're not able, because you don't get born with an innate knowledge of your family. And so once you realize that the Habsburgs were present in European history mostly all of the time from the 13th to the 20th century, you realize that you better look into your family history so that these embarrassing episodes don't happen again. And then you talk to family members, your parents, to uncles. I was lucky enough once in my life to meet the last Empress of Austria, Zita, when I was younger, and we had a long conversation about family history. And with that and with books, you begin to learn more about this family, which is a very nice family. I know I'm probably not totally objective. I might be slightly biased. But it is really a nice family. It's not a family that has had great murders, terrible backstabbings. We never were rulers that that won over our neighbors by force and took whole countries by conquest. We're not like that. The Habsburgs from the beginning were a family that very strongly built upon Catholic teaching and the Catholic idea of marriage, which they used as an instrument to make peace and alliances with countries. The reason for that, again, is, and here I'll take you into Habsburg history, the first we popped up in history around the year 1000. And that was when one of my ancestors built a little castle not too far away from Zurich in Switzerland, the Habsburg. And but the first one who really stepped into the great limelight of history was Rudolf von Habsburg in 1273. Now you have to understand that in 1273, the Holy Roman Empire, which covered basically Germany and neighboring countries down to Italy, had been in a terrible turmoil for 25 years, the so-called interregnum. And in that time, there was no emperor. The electors couldn't agree on one. So in that time, there was lawlessness and chaos in the empire. And they decided to pick a harmless elderly count from Switzerland that would most definitely never begin a dynasty. Boy, were they ever wrong. That was Rudolf von Habsburg, and he was a great emperor in as that he managed to restore peace, justice in the empire in very short time. He was very, very good in that. But here I have to pause and say, what is an empire? And I think that most people today, due to Star Wars mostly, have very, very wrong ideas about empires. An empire is not a place where an evil old emperor suppresses several countries by violence of his stormtroopers and cackles evilly and says, everything is going according to plan. But an empire, especially the Holy Roman Empire and afterwards the Habsburg Empire, was something very different. It was from the beginning a hodgepodge, a complicated chessboard of different nations, different forms of government, different languages, in a very delicate balance among each other. The role of the emperor was to enforce peace and justice upon this. All that he had for that was his name, his authority, and the quasi-sacral aura, because he had been anointed to be emperor with religious ritual. But apart from that, he had very little else. He had not much money. He had never had a capital. He had no big armies. He never had diplomats working for him. So what he had to do from the beginning was a very complex juggling and diplomacy game. And one of the best ways to keep peace between two neighboring countries is to marry off the children of the rulers among each other. It's a very simple way. That may not always be the most romantic or most pleasant path for the children, but in my book I claim that we should think twice about this. But it is almost guaranteed to keep peace between neighboring countries. So the Habsburgs did that from the very beginning, from the first minutes of stepping onto the stage of history. They did that and very long, became famous for that. There is a famous Latin saying, Bella gerant alii tu Felix Austria nube. Others may wage wars, but you, happy Austria, get married. And that's what they did. A very, very brief history of the Habsburgs. So 1273 is the first date you need to keep in mind. Then the first Habsburg became emperor. In reality, he was only king of the Holy Roman Empire because he was never physically crowned by the Pope. And then immediately after Rudolf, the Habsburgs lost the crown again and dropped into near obscurity for about 150 years. We're furious about that. Never became one of the electors of the Holy Roman Empire. At that time, they were also thrown out of Switzerland by the Swiss Eidgenossen and at the battles of Morgarten and Sempach. And then we were in Austria because, of course, Rudolf had given two of his sons parts of Austria that he had fought back from Ottokar of Bohemia, who had stolen it from the empire. And so the Habsburgs were in Austria for a long time, and mostly in Austria, until around the year 1450, 1500, the Habsburgs again exploded into world history by first taking Burgundy by marriage, one of the most romantic and beautiful love stories and adventure stories ever written was the one of Maximilian of Habsburg and how he won the hand, the heart, and the dukedom of Mary of Burgundy. It's in my book. But briefly after that, through marrying off his two children, and after that, two of his grandchildren, Maximilian not only got the Habsburgs on the throne of Spain, and with that, as rulers of large parts of the known world then, but also got Hungary and Bohemia for the Habsburgs. And suddenly, it wasn't only Austria, but Austria, Burgundy, which basically is Belgium, Netherlands, and bits of it, which is later on the famous Spanish Netherlands, Spain, and large parts of the world. The first governor of Texas was put there by the Spanish Habsburgs. So America was touched, South America in large parts, the Philippines that were called after King Philip of Spain. while the other, the one branch of the Habsburg looked after Spain, the other branch was the Vienna branch, the Austrian Habsburgs, and they were the emperors, and the others ruled over the rest of the world. And in order to keep these two branches and the empire together, the Habsburgs over 150 years until the year 1700 very often married to and fro between these two branches. This is what is now gladly called inbreeding. And this was also the time of the paintings with the famous Habsburg jaw, which I get quite often on Twitter. When people think that they are being funny, they sent me pictures of my ancestors with a Habsburg jaw. I usually tell them that this was more than 400 years ago. What they also don't know is, while it is true that the cross marrying between two branches of the Habsburgs wasn't good for the genetics and in the end led to the extinction of the Spanish branch, the Habsburg jaw does not come from inbreeding. This must be very disappointing to people out there to learn that, because it would be so nice if it would be the result of inbreeding. But if you go on Google and you Google Maximilian of Habsburg, the grandfather of the first Spanish Habsburg king, then you will see that he and his children already had the Habsburg jaw long before there was any sort of marrying between Habsburgs. And that came from probably from a Polish ancestor. So there goes another myth. Yes. So after that, there was only the Austrian branch. And after that, you had the famous Maria Theresia with her 16 children, her son Leopold with his 16 children, and after that, Franz Joseph, of course, and in the end, Blessed Emperor Karl, his grandnephew, the last emperor. And then we are in 1918, and the Habsburg reign ends. So that gives you a short overview over the Habsburg history.
Edward, thanks for that wonderful history. I think that'll be very informative for our students, and it was for me as well. I'm wondering if you could speak more about your own personal education. What was the education of Edward Habsburg? With the rise in interest in classical education here in the United States, I'm curious, you know, what books were you introduced to? What did that formation look like? But then also, beyond just the books that you studied, what were the other habits, and whether it's religious habits or whether it was just what it means to be a gentleman today? What were some of the other formations that you received?
Well, Johnny, I could talk about an hour about this. We don't have an hour. One of your topics is freedom. And funnily enough, my parents didn't read much novels, but they had one copy of 1984 in their shelf. And I read this as a rather early in, as a boy. It impressed me. It was gruesome. And I thought we could never get into such a situation again. And I reread it during the pandemic. And during the things that happened there, it was quite poignant to reread this. I got a classical education. I went to a classical school and had 9 years of Latin and 3 years of Greek, classical Greek. I studied Thomas Aquinas in studies. I did my doctoral thesis on Thomistic philosophy. So this is for the serious part. My image of the United States, I got mostly through many, many, many Stephen King novels far too early in my life, which led to not sleeping well at night. But it gave me a good grasp of American small town life and American culture. Of course, many, 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 many movies, many movies. Yes. Then I, after finishing my doctoral thesis in philosophy, I began working. I got married. I'm married with six children. I got to working first for a TV company in Bavaria, where I produced children's TV. And then I went to work for an animation studio in Germany. I was producer on two animated series. Hence my lifelong passion for animation and also Japanese anime, which sometimes makes my Twitter fans freak out, because the combination of Habsburg and Japanese anime is, I think, just makes the brain explode. Yes, So that was, I'm an incredibly avid reader. I'm reading all the time. Thank God all my children are also very avid readers. They read classics, and I'm very thankful for that, because this is the way. This is the way you get an open mind. This is the way you become humble. So classical education is incredibly important. But at the same time, of course, the thing forming me and shaping me most of all is my Catholic faith. I think that's not overdoing it, saying that it's probably the strongest influence in my life, be it for my thought and for my outlook on life, be it for my, also for my personal life, be it for the fact I got married because I'm a Catholic. Our idea of marriage is a Catholic one. We were open for children. We have 6. God is very gracious with us. It's the most important thing that you can do. If you find a spouse that shares your faith, your outlook, your values, your ideas about marriage. And all of this, God was gracious enough to give to me and to grant to me. And then I became, first, as I said, animation producer, then scriptwriter for a few years. I wrote several screenplays, among others, one zombie movie, which unfortunately or fortunately never got made. But it would have been rather cool, long before the current zombie craze. And then because I had like 4 children and realized that with script writing you cannot feed a family, I worked for 5 years, and it was a great time, for a Catholic bishop in Austria, where I was his spokesman and media person. And that was when I began being on Twitter. That also was when I began meeting and interacting with journalists, which I've done ever since. I love every minute. I only made good experiences with journalists. I think I trust them, they trust me. And after 5 years of that, I was approached by the Hungarian government. Oh, I forgot. I also made a TV series. I was one of the 2 presenters of a TV series that ran for 2 years on castles in Germany and Austria, where I hosted this with a famous German actress together. And so I learned about TV and all that. And finally, the Hungarian government reached out to me to ask me whether I wanted to be their ambassador to the Holy See. And I became ambassador in 2015. I'm still here. And the crowning achievement, I would say, of the last 8 years, which is very long for a diplomat to a post, has been the visit of Pope Francis in Hungary that just ended a week ago and was a smashing success, I would say.
It very much looked like a success from all the pictures on Twitter. So congratulations for that. I do have one quick follow-up question on the education side of things. One of my personal interests is the Mirrors for Princes genre of literature. And I actually have a book coming out with Regnery Publishing that'll be an edited collection of the best of the Mirrors for Princes tradition, going back from Xenophon's The Education of Cyrus all the way to Thomas Aquinas on Kingship to Thomas Whoa. More's Utopia. Whoa. So it's a lot of fun. I've been working on it for over a year, and Marlo has heard me talking about it ad nauseum, so she's probably ready for the book to be over. But I'm curious, I'm sort of in the very final stages, submitting the manuscript at the end of June, and I'm interested if the Habsburg family, I'm certain that they were, you know, presented different mirrors when, you know, new kings or queens ascended to the throne. Are there any that you would particularly recommend that meant a lot to your family that I might consider including in the collection?
Johnny, I have to disappoint you. I'm not aware of any Mirror for Princes for the Habsburgs, and I will tell you, I've never read one. I've only heard about them, and I would be very thrilled to read yours.
Okay.
Because I always felt that, you know, I'm sure there were memorandums, bucket lists. I know, for instance, there was a memorandum for the education of the future Francis II, written by Joseph II, exactly detailing how the future emperor should be formed. Yes, we have that, but not as you describe it. So I'm very curious to read that once it comes out, but I can't help you with that. I'm sorry.
Got it.
So something that I'm curious about, especially given the coronation of Charles III in London this past Was that this weekend? This past weekend. And yes. It was a beautiful ceremony. And it's a tradition that's rather alien to Americans. And as an American, I'm very curious about, you talked about this a little bit earlier, but you know, we obviously have a very controversial revolution that led to the founding of this country. So Americans are very much so in this frame of mind that empire and, you know, royal families are not a part of our tradition. In fact, they're a part of our separation from that tradition. So, and you spent some time, just a few, sounded like you, are you still in the US or did you?
No, I'm back. Okay. I'm
back. So you recently left. And you were in our nation's capital and also Philadelphia. So how would you communicate to an American who just finds, you know, the entire concept of royal families and imperial power so alien and foreign to our history and how we relate to power dynamics?
Marlo, this is a very good question. If you get me talking on this again, I would be here for about 1 hour. The most surprising discovery that I made while writing this book is while your first idea would be that there couldn't be anything far more alien from each other than the United States of America and the Habsburg Empire, I think I can prove in my book that there is a number of elements that strongly indicate that we are closer to each other than we think. Yes, I would circle around three things that are very close. One of them is the whole topic of subsidiarity and the way the United States are built and the way the Habsburg Empire was built, in the best of cases. The second is, I think family plays a far greater role in the United States than it does in Europe now, and it still is strong in the Habsburg family and was. And the third one is, I think, the idea of Americans are a very upright people. You're a very, what you see is what you get people. And you, I think there is a great desire for upright, good, honest politicians. Some people have lost the faith in that in the States in the last 3 years. The Habsburgs stand very strongly for this idea of an upright, honest, serving statesman. And I'm going to talk briefly about all three of them if you want to. The central one is subsidiarity. One of the theories of my book, but this is, of course, I haven't written a scientific study and I haven't written a history book. This is a love letter to my family. But you realize that the Habsburg Empire was strongly built about the idea of respect of the lower levels. Ideally, the emperor had to respect every single country under him in their languages, in their structures, their rights, their juridical basis, their habits. This is something that Charles V writes to his son Philip II in a letter. He says, if you don't respect every single nation inside your empire, in all these details, then you're going to be in big trouble. And whenever the Habsburgs tried to move away from a together of different nations respecting every single nation into let's build a centralistic state with a capital and one language, it went really bad. It went really bad. The Habsburgs did this a few times and it always went bad. Because their strength of the Habsburg Empire is a great respect for the lower levels. That meant, for instance, that in the last century of the monarchy, in the parliament, you spoke in all the languages of the empire, and you gave every single country the right to debate their things in the parliament, which sometimes led to endlessly long sessions just for respect for the lower level, for respect for the single country. So the idea is basically subsidiarity. I don't have to explain it to you. Is the idea that the lower level, the level closer to the bases, should do the things that are being dealt with on lower level, and the federal level should be weaker, ideally. And that is the basis of the Holy Roman Empire and, of course, of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and, of course, of the United States. You are built from grassroots up. You're built from family, homestead, township, how do you call the region? I don't know. And the state is like the highest level. The federal level in the basic idea of the United States was very weak. And you could feel a bit of that in the last 2 or 3 years where you feel that sometimes states take decisions that go against what the federal level would like to have, there you still feel flashes of that power of the of those United States that you are. So I think this is a language that both the United States and the Habsburg Empire understand. And whenever the Habsburgs went against that, it went wrong. Joseph II mostly. Joseph II tried to introduce one language, tried to make a centralistic empire because he was trying to ape Frederick of Prussia. We're here in the 18th century. He very much admired him for making Prussia a working, functioning clockwork. And this, of course, is possible if you're a one nation state like Prussia was. But you can't do that with an empire with different nationalities. And what he also did is he took the crowns from Bohemia and from Hungary and brought them into the Schatzkammer in Vienna and locked them in. I said, we don't need a crown in Hungary. We've got one empire. The language is German and the capital is Vienna. And that led to real trouble. And his brother, one of the first things he did was not only that Joseph, weeks before dying, ordered the crown to be brought back to Hungary, but his brother immediately went to Hungary to let himself be crowned king of Hungary to show the lower level the respect for their habits. Okay, so this is one topic. The other topic where I find lots of joy in the United States, this is mostly, of course, in Catholic circles and perhaps in more conservative, but is just an understanding for the importance of family. We don't have that in Europe anymore. I think in Europe, everybody tries to pretend at least that they are all singles. Most of the prime ministers do. We, thank God, in Hungary have a prime minister and a president who both have a family and show themselves with a family. And I have a government, Hungary, that is strongly fighting to encourage people to have numerous families with many children. In the United States, when I arrived to my trip in Philadelphia, first evening, and I came in to a dinner and I was asked how many children I had, and I boasted with my 6 children. And I saw looks of, you know, pity, because there were at least 2 women in the room who had 9 or 10 children, which is something that doesn't ever exist anywhere, at least in the German-speaking world, in Hungary, in surroundings. Still not, I hope one day again, because I believe that numerous families, that's one of the topics of my book, are a great gift for the spouses, great gift for society, and great gift for the children among themselves. So this is a topic that is more understood, at least in some parts of the United States. And I went to masses there where, I mean, the pews were filled with children and also some parents, but mostly children. This is something you never see in Europe. So the family is a topic that is better understood in the States and is also very well understood in the Habsburg Empire. And then, of course, finally, what did I say? What was the last point? Yes, upright statesmen. I talk about this a lot. One of the chapters of my book is called Stand for Just for Law, Justice and Your Subjects. And the example I like to bring, my theory is that most Habsburg emperors really stood for their subjects. They weren't tyrants at all in the term. And even if, of course, there are always bad rulers, the chance of a ruler being bad nowadays or in the last 150 years is very small. The education of a ruler goes to serve. I am in the lucky situation of having met most of the current kings and grand dukes of Europe, or queens, when they were in training, and talk with them and see how they were formed. And, you know, you will grow up and watch your father or mother doing the job, and you learn from them. You get to know every player in the country, every fault line in the country, every potential problem in the country from childhood on. But you never get to know it as a politician who thinks, how can I deal best with this to be re-elected in 4 years' time? But you come to it as someone who knows I'm going to serve my country for all my life. I can't walk out of this and get a plum job somewhere in business after my career as a politician. I'm stuck with this, and my son or my daughter will have to deal with this later on. So you take it very serious, and your decisions that you make are ideally and mostly for the good of the country and not for your own furtherment and career, because you can't get anywhere. That's the advantage. Now, of course, if you're a bad king, this can go wrong, but most kings aren't bad. I would say my theory is there is a lot of propaganda about this, and the ones I got to know are fantastic, served their country with deep humility, knowing that they exist to serve And I don't know whether we can say this of many of our politicians nowadays. It's a temptation, you know, when you get handed lots of power for a while, to use your contacts later on to have a nice life and never be responsible again for your country. I'm just saying all of these things to see why Americans seem to be so incredibly fans of the Habsburgs. Because, and I would say, you know probably that I did on Twitter, I did a world championship of the Habsburgs over the last weeks. If you followed my account, I see you didn't, you will see that I made polls. People could vote for their favorite Habsburgs through several weeks. And in the end, the man winning was the last Habsburg emperor, who was emperor for 1.5 years, lost the empire, lost the war, failed twice to return to Hungary to take back his crown, and died very soon after, miserably in exile. Now, this is a loser, if there ever was one, in the eyes of the world. But he's probably the best-known Habsburg nowadays, especially in the States. The amount of people who love and admire and adore this man is, you can't imagine. I've been to a conference where there were 700 people in the room, all of them young, many families. And he is the example. Why? Because he is incredibly honest, incredibly upright, incredibly good, serving, really serving, and a great husband, loving husband, and a great Christian, deeply, deeply devout, and giving everything, and also a great emperor. As a niece of mine once said, he was wonderful in his job, which happened to be emperor. And in the end of his life, he offered his life for his people. When he lay dying, he offered up his suffering for his people. This is an example. And that's, in my humble opinion, the reason why the Americans, which should abhor and be terrified of tyrants, rulers, and kings, love the Habsburgs. Many do, because they see a clean family, an upright family, a good family that honestly try to serve their people as good as they can under the eyes of God.
Edward, we've moved through, interestingly enough, at least the first three lessons from your book, which are get married, have lots of kids, be Catholic, and love the empire. So that's a great summary of those three points. I do want to get to the other four. And of course, you're free to share more about the first three throughout. But I do have one, maybe a question more relating to political philosophy and contemporary issues that the things you were saying kind of brought up to me. I think right now, you know, there are several friends of ISI. I think of one, Yoram Hazzoni, who wrote a book, The Virtue of Nationalism, and then another, Philip Blond in England, who has a piece in the recent issue of Modern Age in defense of empire. And, you know, Philip would argue that empire is a better route to securing both liberty and subsidiarity and solidarity, and that there is sort of greater, you know, diversity and plurality and tolerance in an empire imperial yes. structure as opposed to nationalism. Where Yoram Hazzoni, who's a, you know, a dear friend, would talk about the experience of Israel and, you know, the virtues of the nation state for inculcating faith, family, you know, those things that we hold dear. And I also know, you know, in the situation in Hungary, you know, you have nationalism, right? And also you have your family's background. And at this point in history, your allies and kind of the cause for traditional values. So I'm curious how you, maybe if you could comment both on these two different types of regimes and also how that's playing out in your own life in Hungary.
Thank you for this very intelligent question. As a diplomat, I would say both is possible. I would say, in fact, I'm a great believer in the power of nation, because it is the antidote to globalism. Nation sovereignty, borders, is something incredibly important and strong. And the main reason why I believe this is because I see how much war is being waged against the idea of nation, by whom? So that's the first thing. The second step, I write this in my book, I say nation is the building block, but the sign of maturity of a nation is its ability to be incorporated in a supranatural structure, but only if that structure respects subsidiarity and each single one of the nation. This was the case in the Habsburg Empire when it went well. This doesn't always seem to be the case, for instance, in the European Union, where we sometimes have the impression that subsidiarity is not followed in the way that it was intended in Article 5 of the founding document of the European Union. And, for instance, Brussels wants to tell us in Hungary how we are supposed to make our laws locally, according to our laws, and gets furious if we make a law that doesn't allow gender ideology to be spread around minors, around schools. All of Europe was screaming and dancing when we did that. But we're a sovereign nation. It's our law. We can do that. And there is an element of something that, in my opinion, again, the Habsburgs also had to learn it. They had to learn to respect the lower level. But nations can live together in an institution if that institution respects the single nations and has a common idea that is shared by all. And that common idea can be a family, like the Habsburgs. If you think about what was the symbol that people in the different parts of the empire looked to, they looked to the figure of the emperor, who is usually an old man with a beard. If you look at the EU and you try to think, what is it that we all have in common? You don't have such a symbol. Some people would say, well, we work together economically, and others would say, well, it's the building of the commission, which looks like a beehive, or the flag somehow. But we don't have that. We don't have that common thing where we say, oh, yes, we all agreed it. It makes things easier if you have. But if this is a leadership that respects the single nations, that's simply, I would say, my answer to you. So Hazonia is right, but the others are right too. Right now, I mean, we all know Austria, Hungary, etc. are not monarchies. And I don't see any indications that this will come soon. But crazier things have happened. And history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. I'm just saying, let's think openly about all these things.
So apropos wrapping up the podcast today, rule number 7 is talking about how we must die well and have a memorable funeral. So the chapter of the book talks about the previous 6 rules towards the fact that we will die, and that our lives must be ordered to the end of our lives on this earth. So you touched on one of your ancestors earlier and his death, which, you know, sounded very noble. So could you talk about perhaps other pre-death rituals and practices within the Habsburg family, how that can perhaps be applied to, people who do not have royal lineage, but that you would recommend for how we can, memento mori and think about our deaths in a way that is, honorable towards God and our family members and, in this context, Americans.
I think it's one of the central elements of the Habsburg family is that all of those emperors and family members lived with clearly death before their eyes, not because they had some sort of death wish, but because they always knew that the way they would die would decide about their eternal happiness. They knew that they had to be ready for death. This is something you prepare all your life. And I would say that most Habsburg, not all of them, unfortunately in my book I'm going to give a few examples of some who didn't, wanted to die as Catholics, with the sacraments, with prayer, and in the state of grace mostly, the chance to go to confession and to prepare for death. One very touching story is because the one who tells us is not suspicious of romanticizing, is the story of the death of one of the daughters of Maria Theresia. Smallpox came to the Hofburg in Vienna, and smallpox in the 18th century meant either death or disfigurement for life. Your beauty was gone. And Franz Stefan of Lorraine, husband of Maria Theresia, writes in one of his letters about the death of his daughter. And he says she got smallpox. Her first reaction immediately on knowing that she had caught the disease was that she asked for a priest and she made a life confession. That was the first. Not even thinking, oh God, am I going to be ugly? What? The first reaction was to ask for a priest and make a life confession. She died very few days later. So you see, even a 10-year-old child had their priorities right. And I think I describe in that chapter a lot of very grandiose and bombastic funeral arrangements. Most of us won't be in the situation to do that. But what we can do is we can prepare for death. We can, if we're Catholic, we can pray God for a good death. We can tell God that we accept death the way he will send it our way, whether that's a car crash or lying for months in a hospital or anything else. Even, you know, in a way losing your mind and having Alzheimer's or something like that, accepting this for the greater glory of God, for your own sanctification, and praying about death, thinking about death. I mean, at least every week on Friday when you contemplate the suffering of Christ, this is a good moment to do so. And then live the sacraments. This is something everyone can do. You don't have to be a grandiose Habsburg knight to do that. But if you happen to be emperor, of course it's important to have a grandiose funeral, not in order to show off and not in order to be remembered by posterity, but to teach your subjects that you are a poor sinner and nothing else, in terrible need of grace. That's what the Habsburgs did with their funeral ritual. That's what several Habsburgs did with their testamentary suggestions. And I strongly urge everybody who buys this book, read chapter 7. There are a few fantastic stories. If we still had 10 more minutes, I would tell them, all of you. But right now, you have to read them.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's the perfect note. A good death to end our podcast on. So thank you so much for joining us, Edward. If people want to purchase your book or follow you, where can they find you?
The book, if you are in the States, the book ideally should be acquired from the homepage of Sophia Institute Press. Then, of course, you can go to your online retailer of choice if you're somewhere else. If you want to follow me, you go on Twitter. I have currently 60,000 followers, which allows me still to interact, to react. You can reach me via direct message and come to a very, very wholesome Twitter community, the people around me. And yes, and apart from that, read the book and do things the Habsburg way.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again,
and
Edward.
Sorry, Johnny. Thank you and Marlo for the very intelligent questions. I enjoyed this conversation immensely.
Thank you.
We did too. Well, thank you all for listening to Conservative Conversations with ISI. If you've enjoyed this podcast, be sure to head over to isi.org/resources to see all that we offer our members, including the Intercollegiate Review, select Modern Age articles, and of course, this podcast. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to rate and review, and we will see you next time on Conservative Conversations with ISI.